sense of humor. He never undertakes any physics project lightly, without the intent of mastering the relevant field. His physics textbooks are masterpieces, and his popular writing is lucid and full of wisdom. An avid reader of ancient history, Weinberg fully communicates the historical perspective not only on what he is doing, but also on the whole physics enterprise. Weinberg's approach to physics is like that of a steamroller. When I was at Harvard, we postdocs used to call Weinberg Big Steve. When he was working on a problem, the best thing you could do was get out of the way, or you'd be rolled over by the immense power of his intellect and energy. Earlier, before I moved to Harvard and was still at MIT, a friend of mine at the time, Lawrence Hall, was a graduate student at Harvard. Lawrence was ahead of me in his work, graduating before me. He told me that he was only able to complete the work that became his thesis with Weinberg, because Weinberg had just won the Nobel Prize in 1979, and the ensuing hubbub forced him to slow down enough so that Lawrence could complete his calculations before Weinberg beat him to the punch. One of the great fortunes of my life was to have the opportunity to work closely with both Glashow and Weinberg during the early and formative years of my own career. After Glashow helped rescue me from the black hole of mathematical physics, he became my collaborator at Harvard and for years later. Weinberg taught me much of what I know about particle theory. At MIT, one doesn't have to take courses, just pass exams, so I only took one or two physics courses at MIT while working toward my PhD. But one of the perks of being at MIT was that I could take classes at Harvard. I took or sat in on every graduate class that Weinberg taught during my graduate career, from quantum field theory onward. Glashow and Weinberg formed complementary role models for my own career. At my best, I've tried to emulate aspects I learned from each of them, while recognizing that most often my best wasn't much in comparison. Weinberg had and has a broad and abiding interest in the details of quantum field theory, and like many others during the 1960s, he tried to focus on how one might understand the nature of the strong interaction using ideas of symmetry that, in large part due to the work of Gell-Mann, so dominated the field at the time. Weinberg, too, was thinking about the possible application of ideas of symmetry breaking to understand nuclear masses based on Nambu's work, and like Higgs, Weinberg was quite disappointed by Goldstone's result that massless particles would always accompany such physics. So Weinberg decided, as he almost always did when he was interested in some physics idea, that he needed to prove it to himself. Thus, his subsequent paper with Goldstone and Salam provided several independent proofs of the theorem in the context of strongly interacting particles and fields. Weinberg was so despondent about possible explanations of the strong interaction using spontaneous symmetry breaking that he added an epigraph to the draft of the paper that echoed Lear's response to Cordelia. Quote, "Nothing will come of nothing. Speak again." End quote. My book, A Universe from Nothing, makes plain why I am not a big fan of this quote. Quantum mechanics blurs the distinction between something and nothing. Weinberg subsequently learned about Higgs's and others' results that one could get rid of unwanted massless Goldstone bosons that occur through symmetry breaking if the symmetry being broken was a gauge symmetry, where in this case, the massless Goldstone bosons would disappear and otherwise massless gauge bosons would become massive. But Weinberg wasn't particularly impressed, viewing it, as many other physicists did, as an interesting technicality. Moreover, in the early 1960s, the idea that the pion resembled, in many ways, a Goldstone boson was useful in deriving some approximate formulas for certain strong interaction reaction rates. Thus, the notion of getting rid of Goldstone bosons in the strong interaction became less attractive. Weinberg spent several years during this period exploring these ideas. He worked out a theory whereby some symmetries that were thought to be associated with the strong interaction might become broken spontaneously, and various strongly interacting vector gauge particles that convey the strong interaction might get masses by the Higgs mechanism. The problem was he couldn't get agreement with observations without spoiling the initial gauge symmetry that would protect the theory. The only way he could avoid this and preserve the initial gauge symmetry he needed was if some vector particles became massive and others remained massless. But this disagreed with experiment. Then, one day in 1967, while driving in to MIT, he saw the light, literally and metaphorically. I have driven with Steve in Boston, and while I have lived to talk about it, I've seen how when he is thinking about physics, all awareness of large masses such as other cars disappears. Weinberg suddenly realized that maybe he, and everyone else, was applying the right ideas of spontaneous symmetry breaking, but to the wrong problem. Another example in nature could involve two different vector bosons, one type massless and one type massive. The massless vector boson could be the photon, and the massive one, or ones, could be the massive mediators of the weak interaction that had been speculated by Schwinger a decade earlier. If this was true, then the weak and electromagnetic interactions could be described by a unified set of gauge theories, one corresponding to the electromagnetic interaction remaining unbroken, and one corresponding to the weak interaction with a broken gauge symmetry resulting in several massive mediators for that interaction. In this case, the world we live in would be precisely like a superconductor. The weak interaction would be weak because of the simple accident that the ground state of fields in our current universe breaks the gauge symmetry that would otherwise govern the weak interaction symmetry. The photon-like gauge particles would get large masses, and, as Schwinger had expected, the weak interaction would become so short-range that it would almost die off even on the length scale of protons and neutrons. This would also explain why neutron decay would happen so slowly. The massive particles mediating the weak interaction would appear to us just as photons would appear to the hypothetical physicists living inside a superconductor. So too, the distinction between electromagnetism and the weak interaction would be just as illusory as the distinction that physicists on the ice crystal on that window pane would make between forces along the direction of their icicle versus those perpendicular to that direction. It would be a simple accident that one gauge symmetry gets broken in the world of our experience and the other doesn't. Weinberg wanted to avoid thinking about strongly interacting particles since the situation there was still confused. So we decided to think about particles that interact only via the weak or electromagnetic interaction, namely electrons and neutrinos. Since the weak interaction turns electrons into neutrinos, he had to imagine a set of charged, vector, photon-like particles that would produce such a transformation. These are nothing other than the charged vector bosons that Schwinger envisaged, conventionally called the W-plus and W-minus bosons. Since only left-handed electrons and neutrinos get mixed together by the weak interaction, one type of gauge symmetry would have to govern just the interaction of left-handed particles with the W particles. But since both left-handed electrons and right-handed electrons interact with photons, the gauge symmetry of electromagnetism would somehow have to be incorporated in this unified model in such a way that left-handed electrons could interact with both photons and the new charged W bosons, while right-handed electrons would interact only with photons and not the W particles. Mathematically, the only way to do this, as Sheldon Glashow had discovered when he was thinking about electroweak unification 6 years earlier, was if there was one additional neutral weak boson that right and left-handed electrons could interact with in addition to interacting with photons. This new boson, Weinberg dubbed the Z0. A new field would have to exist in nature that would form a condensate in empty space to spontaneously break the symmetries governing the weak interaction. The elementary particle associated with this field would be the massive Higgs, while the remaining would-be Goldstone bosons would now be eaten by the W and Z bosons to make them massive by the mechanism that Higgs first proposed. This would leave only the photon left over as a massless gauge boson. But there's more. By virtue of the gauge symmetry he introduced, Weinberg's new Higgs particle would also interact with electrons, and when the condensate formed, the effect would be to give electrons a mass as well as the W and Z particles. Thus, not only would this model explain the masses of the gauge particles that mediate the weak force, and therefore determine the strength of that force, but the same Higgs field would also give electrons mass. All the ingredients necessary for the unification of the weak and electromagnetic interaction were present in this model. Moreover, by starting with a Yang-Mills gauge theory with massless gauge bosons before symmetry breaking, there was hope that the same remarkable symmetry properties of gauge theories first exploited in quantum electrodynamics might also allow this theory to produce finite, sensible results. While a fundamental theory with massive photon-like particles clearly had pathologies, the hope was that if the masses only resulted after symmetry breaking, these pathologies might not appear. But it was just a hope at the time. Clearly, in a realistic model, the Higgs particle would couple to other particles engaged in the weak interaction beyond the electron. In the absence of a Higgs condensate, all these particles, protons, or the particles that make them up, and muons, etc., all of them would be exactly massless. Every facet that is responsible for our existence, indeed the very existence of the massive particles from which we are made, would thus arise as an accident of nature, the formation of a specific Higgs condensate in our universe. The particular features that make our world what it is, the galaxies, stars, planets, people, and the interactions among all of these would be quite different if the condensate had never formed, or if it had formed differently. Just as the world experienced by imaginary physicists on the ice crystal on that window pane on a cold winter morning would have been completely different if the crystal had lined up in a different direction, so too the features of our world that allow our existence depend crucially on the nature of the Higgs condensate. What might seem so special about the features of the particles and fields that make up the world we live in would thus be no more special, planned, or significant than would be the accidental orientation of the spine of that ice crystal, even if it might appear to have special significance to beings living on the crystal. And one last bit of poetry. The unique Yang-Mills model that Weinberg was driven to in 1967, which Abdus Salam would also stumble upon a year later, was precisely the model proposed 6 years earlier by his old high school friend Sheldon Glashow, when he responded to Schwinger's challenge to find a symmetry that might unify the weak and electromagnetic interactions. No other choice could mathematically reproduce what we see in the world today. Glashow's model had been largely ignored in the interim because no mechanism was then known to give the weak bosons masses. But now such a mechanism existed, the Higgs mechanism. Weinberg and Glashow, whose lives had crisscrossed since they were children, would later share the Nobel Prize, along with Salam, for completely independent discoveries of the greatest unification in physical theory since Maxwell had unified electricity and magnetism, and Einstein had unified space and time. Chapter 18. The Fog Lifts. Their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. Psalm 19, verse 4. You might expect that physicists around the world would have thrown parties with fireworks when Weinberg's paper came out. But for the next 3 years following publication of Weinberg's theory, not a single physicist, not even Weinberg himself, would find cause to reference the paper, now one of the most highly cited papers in all of particle physics. If a great discovery about nature had been made, no one had yet noticed. After all, Maxwell's unification made the beautiful prediction that light was an electromagnetic wave whose speed could be calculated from first principles. And lo and behold, the prediction was equal to the measured speed of light. Einstein's unification of space and time predicted that clocks would slow down for moving observers, and lo and behold, they do, in just the way he predicted. In 1967, the Glashow-Weinberg-Salam unification of the weak and electromagnetic interactions predicted three new vector bosons that were almost 100 times heavier than any particle that had yet been detected. It also predicted new interactions between electrons and neutrinos and matter due to the newly predicted Z particle that had not only not been seen, but a number of experiments suggested did not exist. It also required the existence of a new and as yet unobserved massive fundamental scalar boson, the Higgs particle, when no fundamental scalar particles were yet known to exist in nature. And finally, as a quantum theory, no one knew if it made sense. Is it any wonder that the idea did not immediately catch fire? Nevertheless, within a decade, everything would change, resulting in the most theoretically productive period for elementary particle physics since the discovery of quantum mechanics. While a gauge theory of the weak interactions started the ball rolling, what resulted was far greater. The first crack in the dike holding back the waters of progress came, fittingly, with the work of Dutch graduate student Gerardus de Tooft in 1971. I always remember how to spell his name because a particularly brilliant and witty former Harvard colleague, the late Sidney Coleman, used to say that if Gerard had monogram cufflinks, they would need an apostrophe on them. Before 1971, many of the greatest theorists in the world had tried to figure out whether the infinities that plague most quantum field theories would disappear for spontaneously broken gauge theories as they do for their unbroken cousins. But the answer eluded them. Remarkably, this young graduate student, working under the supervision of a seasoned pro, Martinus Veltmann, found a proof that others had missed. Often, when presented with a new result, we physicists can work through the details and imagine how we might have discovered it ourselves. But many of Atuf's insights, and there were many, almost all the new ideas in the 1970s derived in one way or another from his theoretical inventions, seemed to come from some hidden reservoir of intuition. The other remarkable thing about Gerard is how gentle, shy, and unassuming he is. For someone who became famous in the field when he was a student, one might have expected some sense of privilege. But from the first time I met him, again when I was a lowly graduate student, Gerard treated me as an interesting friend, and I am pleased to say that relationship has continued. I always try to remember this attitude when I meet young graduate students who seem shy or intimidated, and I try to emulate Gerard's open generosity of spirit. His supervisor, Tini Veltmann, as he's often called, couldn't appear more different. Not that Tini isn't fun to talk to. He is. But he always made explicitly clear to me the moment we started a discussion that whatever I might say, I didn't understand things well enough. I always enjoyed the challenge. It is important to note that Atuft would never have approached the problem if Veltmann had not been obsessed with it, even as many others gave up. The notion that one might ultimately extend the techniques that Feynman and others had developed to tame quantum electrodynamics, to try and understand more complex theories, such as spontaneously broken Yang-Mills theory, was simply viewed as naive by many in the field. But Veltmann stayed with the project, and he wisely found a graduate student who was also a genius to help him. It took a while for Tufts and Veltmann's ideas to sink in, and the new techniques Atuft had developed to become universally adopted. But within a year or so, physicists agreed that the theory that Weinberg and later Salam had proposed made sense. Citations of Weinberg's paper suddenly began to grow exponentially. But making sense and being right are two different things. Did nature actually use the specific theory that Glashow, Weinberg, and Salam had suggested? That remained the key open question, and for a while, it looked as if the answer was no. The existence of the new neutral particle, the Z, required by the theory, was a significant addition beyond the charged particles suggested years earlier by Schwinger and others that were required to change neutrons into protons and electrons into neutrinos. It meant that there would be a new kind of weak interaction, not just for electrons and neutrinos, but also for protons and neutrons, mediated by a new neutral particle exchange. In this case, as for electromagnetism, the identity of the particles interacting would not change. Such interactions became known as neutral current interactions, and the obvious way to test the theory was to look for them. The best place to look for them was in the interactions of the only particles in nature that just feel the weak interaction, namely neutrinos. You may recall that the prediction of such neutral currents was one of the reasons that Glashow's 1961 suggestion never caught on. But Glashow's model wasn't a full theory. Particle masses were simply put into the equations by hand, and as a result, quantum corrections couldn't be controlled. However, when Weinberg and Salam proposed their model for electroweak unification, all the elements that allowed for detailed predictions were there. The mass of the Z particle was predicted. And as Atuft had shown, one could calculate all quantum corrections in a reliable way, just as one did for quantum electrodynamics. This was a good thing, and a bad thing, because no wiggle room was left to argue away any possible disagreements with observation. And in 1967, there appeared to be such disagreements. No such neutral currents had been observed in high-energy collisions of neutrinos with protons, with an upper limit being set of about 10% of the rate observed for more familiar, charge-changing weak interactions of neutrinos and protons, such as neutron decay. Things looked bad, and most physicists assumed weak neutral currents didn't exist. Weinberg had a vested interest in this quest, and in 1971, he reasonably argued there was still wiggle room. But this view was not generally held by others in the community. In the early 1970s, new experiments at the European Organization for Nuclear Research, or CERN as it's known, in Geneva, were performed using the proton accelerator there, which smashed high-energy protons into a long target. Most particles produced in the collision would be absorbed in the target, but neutrinos would emerge from the other end, as their interactions are so weak that they could traverse the target without being absorbed. The resulting high-energy neutrino beam would then strike a detector placed in its path that could record the few events in which neutrinos might interact with the detector material. A huge new detector was built, named Gargamel, after the giantess mother of Gargantua, from the work of the French writer Rabelais. This 5-meter by 2-meter bubble chamber vessel was filled with a superheated liquid in which trails of bubbles would form when an energetic charged particle traversed it, sort of like seeing the vapor trail high in the sky of a plane that itself is not visible. Interestingly, when the experimentalists who built Gargamel met in 1968 to discuss their plans for neutrino experiments, the idea of searching for neutral currents wasn't even mentioned, an indication of how many physicists thought the issue was then settled. Of far more interest to them was the possibility of following up on recent exciting experiments at the Stanford Linear Accelerator, or SLAC, where high-energy electrons had been used as probes to explore the structure of protons. Using neutrinos as probes of protons might give cleaner measurements because the neutrinos are not charged. After the results of Tuft and Veltman, however, in 1972, experimentalists began to take the gauge theory description of the weak interaction, and in particular the Glashow-Weinberg-Salam proposal, seriously. That meant looking for neutral currents. The Gargamel collaboration had the capability to do this in principle, even though it hadn't been designed for the task. Most of the high-energy neutrinos in the beam would interact with protons in the target by turning into muons, the heavier charged partners of electrons. The muons would exit the target, producing a long charged particle track all the way to the edge of the detector. The protons would be converted into neutrons, which would themselves not produce a track, but would collide with nuclei, producing a short shower of charged particles that would leave tracks. Thus, the experiment was designed to detect muon tracks, as well as accompanying charged particle showers, both arising as separate signals of a single weak interaction. However, sometimes a neutrino would interact with material outside the detector, producing a neutron that might recoil back into the detector and then interact there. Such events would consist of a single, strongly interacting shower of particles due to the colliding neutron, with no accompanying muon track. When Gargamel began to search for neutral current events, such isolated charged particle showers without an accompanying muon became just the signal that scientists needed to focus on. In neutral current events, a neutrino that interacts with a neutron or proton in the detector doesn't convert into a charged muon, but simply bounces off and escapes the detector unobserved. All that would be observed would be the recoiling nuclear shower, the same signature produced by the more standard neutrino interactions outside the detector that produce neutrons that recoil back into the detector and produce a nuclear shower. The challenge then, if the experiment was to definitively detect neutral current events, was to distinguish neutrino-induced events from such neutron-induced events. This same problem has provided the chief challenge to experimentalists looking for any weakly interacting particles, including the presumed dark matter particles that are being searched for in underground detectors around the world today. The observation of a single recoil electron with no other charged particle tracks in the detector was observed in 1973. This could have arisen from the less frequent predicted neutral current collisions of neutrinos with electrons instead of protons and neutrons. But generally, a single event is not enough to definitively claim a new discovery in particle physics. However, it did give hope, and by March of 1973, a careful analysis of neutron backgrounds and observed isolated particle showers appeared to provide evidence that weak neutral current interactions actually exist. Nevertheless, not until July of 1973 did the researchers at CERN complete a sufficient number of checks to be confident enough to claim a detection of neutral currents, which they did at a conference in Bonn in August. The story might have ended there, but unfortunately, shortly after this, another collaboration searching for neutral currents rechecked their apparatus and found that a previous signal for neutral currents had disappeared. This produced significant confusion and skepticism in the physics community, where once again, neutral currents seemed suspect. Ultimately, the Gargamel collaboration returned to the drawing board, tested the detector using a proton beam directly, and took a great deal more data. At a conference almost a year later in June 1974, the Gargamel collaboration presented overwhelming confirmation of the signal. Meanwhile, the competing collaboration had found the cause of its error and confirmed the Gargamel result. Glashow, Weinberg, and Salam were vindicated. Neutral currents had arrived, and a remarkable unification of the weak and the electromagnetic interactions appeared to be at hand. But two loose ends still remained to be cleared up. The existence of neutral currents in neutrino scattering validated the notion that the Z particle existed. But this didn't guarantee that the weak interaction was identical to that proposed by Glashow, Weinberg, and Salam, where the weak and electromagnetic interactions were unified. To explore this required an experiment using a particle that participated in both the weak and the electromagnetic interaction. The electron was ideal for this purpose because these are the only two interactions it experiences. When electrons interact with other charges by their electromagnetic attraction, left-handed electrons and right-handed electrons behave identically. However, the Glashow-Weinberg-Salam theory required that weak interactions occurred differently for left-handed versus right-handed particles. This implied that careful measurements of the scattering of polarized electrons, electrons initially prepared in left or right-handed states using magnetic fields, off various targets should reveal a violation of left-right symmetry, but not as extreme an asymmetry as that observed in neutrino scattering, because the neutrino is purely left-handed. The degree of violation in electron scattering, if it existed, would then reflect the extent to which the weak interaction and electromagnetic interaction were mixed together in a unified theory. The idea of testing for such interference using electron scattering had actually been suggested as early as 1958 by the remarkable Soviet physicist Yakov B. Zeldovich, but it would take 20 years for sufficiently sensitive experiments to actually take place. And as for the neutral current discovery, the road to success was full of potholes and wrong turns along the way. One of the reasons it took so long to test this idea is that the weak interaction is weak. Because the dominant interaction of electrons with matter is electromagnetic, the left-right asymmetry predicted due to a possible exchange of a Z particle was small, smaller than one part in 10,000. To test for such a small asymmetry required both an intense beam and one whose initial polarization was well determined. The best place to perform these experiments was at the Stanford Linear Accelerator, a 2-mile-long electron linear accelerator built in 1962 that was the longest and straightest structure that had ever been built. In 1970, polarized beams were introduced, but not until 1978 was an experiment designed and run with the sensitivity required to look for weak electromagnetic interference and electron scattering. While the successful observation of neutral currents in 1974 meant that the Glashow-Weinberg-Salam theory began to have wide acceptance among theorists, what made the 1978 SLAC experiment so important was that in 1977, two atomic physics experiments had reported results that, if correct, convincingly ruled out the theory. In our story thus far, light has played a crucial role, illuminating, if you'll forgive the pun, our understanding not only of electricity and magnetism, but also space, time, and ultimately the nature of the quantum world. So too, it was realized that light could help probe for a possible electroweak unification. The first great success of quantum electrodynamics was the correct prediction of the spectrum of hydrogen and eventually other atoms. But if electrons also feel the weak force, then this will provide a small additional force between electrons and nuclei that should alter, if slightly, the characteristics of their atomic orbits. For the most part, these are unobservable because electromagnetic effects swamp weak effects. But weak interactions violate parity. So the same weak electromagnetic neutral current interference that was being explored using polarized electron beams can produce novel effects in atoms that would vanish if electromagnetism was the only force involved. In particular, for heavy atoms, the Glashow-Weinberg-Salam theory predicted that if polarized light was transmitted through a gas of atoms, then the direction of the polarization of the light would be rotated by about a millionth of a degree due to parity-violating neutral current effects in the atoms through which the light passed. In 1977, the results of two independent atomic physics experiments in Seattle and Oxford were published in back-to-back articles in Physical Review Letters. The results were dismaying. No such optical rotation was seen at a level 10 times smaller than that predicted by the electroweak theory. Had only one experiment reported the result, it would have been more equivocal. But the same result from two independent experiments using independent techniques made it appear definitive. The theory appeared to be ruled out. Nevertheless, the SLAC experiment, which had begun 3 years earlier, was well underway, and since all the experimental preparation had begun, the experiment was approved to begin to take data in early 1978. Because of the earlier null results from the atomic physics experiments, the Stanford collaboration added several bells and whistles to the experiment so that if they saw no effect, they could guarantee that they could have seen such an effect if it were there. Within 2 months, the experiments began to show clear signs of parity violation. And by June 1978, the scientists announced a non-zero result in agreement with the predictions of the Glashow-Weinberg-Salam model based on measured neutrino neutral current scattering, which measured the strength of the Z interaction. Still, questions remained, especially given the apparent disagreement with the Seattle-Oxford results. At a talk at Caltech on the subject, Richard Feynman characteristically homed in on a key outstanding experimental question and asked whether the SLAC experimentalists had checked that the detector responded equally well to both left-handed and right-handed electrons. They hadn't, but for theoretical reasons, They had no reason to expect the detectors to behave differently for the different polarizations. Feynman would famously get to the heart of another complex problem 8 years later after the tragic Challenger explosion, when he simply demonstrated the failure of an O-ring seal to the investigating committee and to the public watching the televised proceedings. Over the fall, the SLAC experiment refined their efforts to rule out both this concern and others that had been raised, and by the fall, they reported a definitive result in agreement with the Glashow-Weinberg-Salam prediction, with an uncertainty of less than 10%. Electroweak unification was vindicated. To date, I don't know if anyone has a good explanation of why the original atomic physics results were wrong. Later experiments agreed with the Glashow-Weinberg-Salam theory, except that the experiments and the theoretical interpretation of the experiments are hard. But a mere year later, in October 1979, Sheldon Glashow, Abdus Salam, and Steven Weinberg were awarded the Nobel Prize for their electroweak theory, now validated by experiment, that unified two of the four forces of nature based on a single fundamental symmetry, gauge invariance. If the gauge symmetry hadn't been broken, hidden from view, the weak and electromagnetic interactions would look identical. But then all of the particles that make us up wouldn't have mass, and we wouldn't be here to notice. This is not the end of our story, however. Two out of four is still only two out of four. The strong interaction, which had motivated much of the work that led to electroweak unification, had continued to stubbornly resist all attempts at explanation, even as the electroweak theory took shape. No explanation of the strong nuclear force via spontaneously broken gauge symmetries met the test of experiment. Thus, even as the scientist philosophers of the 20th century had stumbled, often by a convoluted and dimly lit path, outside our cave of shadows, to glimpse the otherwise hidden reality beneath the surface, one more force relevant to understanding the fundamental structure of matter was conspicuously missing from the beautiful emerging tapestry of nature. Chapter 19. Free at last. Let my people go. Exodus chapter 9, verse 1. The long road that led to electroweak unification was a tour de force of intellectual perseverance and ingenuity. But it was also a detour de force. Almost all of the major ideas introduced by Yang, Mills, Yukawa, Higgs, and the others that led to this theory were developed in the apparently unsuccessful struggle to understand the strongest force in nature, the strong nuclear force. Recall that this force and the strongly interacting particles that manifested it had so bedeviled physicists that in the 1960s, many of them had given up hope of ever explaining it via the techniques of quantum field theory that had so successfully now described both electromagnetism and the weak interaction. There had been one success, centered on Gell-Mann and Zweig's proposal that all the strongly interacting particles that had been observed, including the proton and the neutron, could be understood as being made up of more fundamental objects, which, as I've described, Gell-Mann called quarks. All the strongly known interacting particles, and at the time undiscovered particles, could be classified, assuming they were made of quarks. Moreover, the symmetry arguments that led Gell-Mann, in particular, to come up with his model, served as the basis for making some sense of the otherwise confusing data associated with the reactions of strongly interacting matter. Nevertheless, Gell-Mann had allowed that his scheme might merely be a mathematical construct, useful for classification, and that quarks might not represent real particles. After all, no free quarks had ever been observed in accelerators or cosmic ray experiments. He was also probably influenced by the popular idea that quantum field theory, and hence the notion of elementary particles themselves, broke down on nuclear scales. Even as late as 1972, Gell-Mann stated, quote, Let us end by emphasizing our main point, that it may well be possible to construct an explicit theory of hadrons based on quarks and some kind of glue. Since the entities we start with are fictitious, there is no need for any conflict with the bootstrap point of view. End quote. Viewed in this context, the effort to describe the strong interaction by Yang-Mills gauge quantum field theory with real gauge particles mediating the force would be misplaced. It also seemed impossible. The strong force appeared to operate only on nuclear scales, so if it was to be described by a gauge theory, the photon-like particles that would convey the force would have to be heavy. But there was also no evidence of a Higgs mechanism, with massive, strongly interacting Higgs-like particles, which experiments could have easily detected. Compounding this, the force was simply so strong that even if it was described by a gauge theory, then all of the quantum field theory techniques developed for deriving predictions, which worked so well for the other forces, would have broken down if applied to the strong force. This is why Gell-Mann, in his quote, referred to the bootstrap, the Zen-like idea that no particles were truly fundamental, the sound of no hands clapping, if you will. Whenever theory faces an impasse like this, it sure helps to have experiment as a guide. And that is exactly what happened in 1968. A series of pivotal experiments performed by Henry Kendall, Jerry Friedman, and Richard Taylor using the newly built slack accelerator to scatter high-energy electrons off protons and neutrons revealed something remarkable. Protons and neutrons did appear to have some substructure, but it was strange. The collisions had properties no one had expected. Was the signal due to quarks? Theorists were quick to come to the rescue. James Bjorkane demonstrated that the phenomena observed by the experimentalists, called scaling, could be understood if protons and neutrons were composed of virtually non-interacting point-like particles. Feynman then interpreted these objects as real particles, which he dubbed partons, and suggested they could be identified with Gell-Mann's quarks. This picture had a big problem, however. If all strongly interacting particles were composed of quarks, then quarks should surely be strongly interacting themselves. Why should they appear to be almost free inside protons and neutrons and not be interacting strongly with each other? Moreover, in 1965, Nambu, Mu-Young Han, and Oscar Greenberg had convincingly argued that if strongly interacting particles were composed of quarks, and if they were fermions like electrons, then Gell-Mann's classification of known particles by various combinations of quarks would only be consistent if quarks possess some new kind of internal charge, a new Yang-Mills gauge charge. This would imply that they interacted strongly via a new set of gauge bosons, which were then called gluons. But where were the gluons? And where were the quarks? And why was there no evidence of quarks interacting strongly inside protons and neutrons if they were really to be identified with Feynman's partons? In yet another problem with quarks, protons and neutrons have weak interactions, and if these particles were made up of quarks, then the quarks would also have to have weak interactions in addition to strong interactions. Gell-Mann had identified three different types of quarks as comprising all known strongly interacting particles at the time. Mesons could be comprised of quark-antiquark pairs, protons and neutrons could be made up of three fractionally charged quarks, which Gell-Mann called up, U, and down, D quarks. The proton would be made of two up quarks and one down quark, while the neutron would be made of two down quarks and one up quark. In addition to these two types of quarks, one additional type of quark, a heavier version of the down quark, was required to make up exotic new elementary particles. Gell-Mann called this the strange, or S quark, and particles containing S quarks were dubbed to possess strangeness. When neutral currents were first proposed as part of the weak interaction, this created a problem. If quarks interacted with the Z particles, then UD and S quarks could remain UD and S quarks before and after the neutral current interaction, just as electrons remained electrons before and after the interaction. However, because the D and S quarks had precisely the same electric and isotopic spin charges, nothing would prevent an S quark from converting into a D quark when it interacted with a Z particle. This would allow particles containing S quarks to decay into particles containing D quarks. But no such, quote, strangeness-changing decays, end quote, were observed with high sensitivity in experiments. Something was wrong. The absence of strangeness-changing neutral currents was explained brilliantly, at least in principle, by Sheldon Glashow, along with collaborators John Iliopoulos and Luciano Maiani in 1970. They took the quark model seriously and suggested that if a fourth quark, dubbed a charmed or C quark, existed, which had the same charge as the U quark, then a remarkable mathematical cancellation could occur in the calculated transformation rate for an S quark into a D quark, and strangeness changing neutral currents would be suppressed in agreement with experiments. Moreover, this scheme began to suggest a nice symmetry between quarks and particles such as electrons and muons, all of which could exist in pairs associated with the weak force. The electron would be paired with its own neutrino, as would the muon. The up and down quarks would form one pair, and the charm and the strange quark another pair. W particles interacting with one particle in each pair would turn it into the other particle in the pair. None of these arguments address the central problems of the strong interaction between quarks, however. Why had no one ever observed a quark? And, if the strong interaction was described by a gauge theory with gluons as the gauge particles, how come no one had ever observed a gluon? And if the gluons were massless, how come the strong force was short range? These problems continue to suggest to some that quantum field theory was the wrong approach for understanding the strong force. Freeman Dyson, who had played such an important role in the development of the first successful quantum field theory, quantum electrodynamics, asserted, when describing the strong interaction, quote, "the correct theory will not be found in the next 100 years, end quote. One of those who were convinced that quantum field theory was doomed was a brilliant young theorist, David Gross. Trained under Jeffrey Chu, the inventor of the bootstrap picture of nuclear democracy, in which elementary particles were an illusion masking a structure in which only symmetries and not particles were real, Gross was well primed to try and kill quantum field theory for good. Recall that even as late as 1965, when Richard Feynman received his Nobel Prize, it was still felt that the procedure he and others had developed for getting rid of infinities in quantum field theory was a trick, that something was fundamentally wrong at small scales with the picture that quantum field theory presented. Russian physicist Lev Landau had shown in the 1950s that the electric charge on an electron depends on the scale at which you measure it. Virtual particles pop out of empty space, and electrons and all other elementary particles are surrounded by a cloud of virtual particle-antiparticle pairs. These pairs screen the charge, just as the charge in a dielectric material gets screened. Positively charged virtual particles tend to closely surround the negative charge, and so at a distance, the physical effects of the initial negative charge are reduced. This meant, according to Landau, that the closer you get to an electron, the larger its actual charge will appear. If we measure the electron charge to be some specific value at large distances, as we do, that would mean that the bare charge on the electron, namely the charge on the fundamental particle considered without all the infinite dressing by particle-antiparticle pairs surrounding it on ever smaller scales, would have to be infinite. Clearly, something was rotten with this picture. Gross was influenced not only by his supervisor, but also by the prevailing sentiments of the time, mostly arguments by Gell-Mann, who dominated theoretical particle physics in the late 50s and early 60s. Gell-Mann advocated using algebraic relations that arise from thinking about field theories, then keeping the relations and throwing away the field theory. In a particularly Gell-Mann-esque description, he stated, quote, "we may compare this process to a method sometimes employed in French cuisine. A piece of pheasant meat is cooked between two slices of veal, which are then discarded," end quote. Thus, one could abstract out properties of quarks that might be useful for predictions, but then ignore the actual possible existence of quarks. However, Gross began to be disenchanted by just using ideas associated with global symmetries and algebras, and longed to explore dynamics that might actually describe the physical processes that were occurring inside strongly interacting particles. Gross and his collaborator, Curtis Callan, built upon earlier work by James Bjorkane to show that the charged particle apparently located inside protons and neutrons had to have spin 1/2, identical to that of electrons. Later, with other collaborators, Gross showed that a similar analysis of neutrino scattering off protons and neutrons as measured at CERN revealed that the components looked just like the quarks that Gell-Mann had proposed. If it quacks like a duck and walks like a duck, it probably is a duck. Thus, for Gross and others, the reality of quarks was now convincing. But as convinced as many such as Gross were by the reality of quarks, they were equally convinced that this implied that field theory could not possibly be the correct way to describe the strong interaction. The results of the experiments required the constituents to be essentially non-interacting, not strongly interacting. In 1969, Gross's colleagues at Princeton, Curtis Callan and Kurt Szymanczyk, rediscovered a set of equations explored by Landau and then Gell-Mann and Francis Lowe that described how quantities in quantum field theory might evolve with scale. If the partons inferred by the slack experiments had any interactions at all, as quarks must have, then measurable departures from the scaling that Bjorkane had derived would occur, and the results that Gross and his collaborators had also derived when comparing theory and slack experiments would also have to be modified. Over the next 2 years, with the results of Atuft and Veltmann and the growing success of the predictions of the theory of the weak and electromagnetic interactions, more people began to turn their attention once again to quantum field theory. Gross decided to prove, in great generality, that no sensible quantum field theory could possibly reproduce the experimental results about the nature of protons and neutrons observed at slack. Thus, he hoped to kill this whole approach to attempting to understand the strong interaction. First, he would prove that the only way to explain the slack results was if somehow, at short distances, the strength of the quantum field interactions would have to go to zero, i.e. the fields would essentially become non-interacting at short distances. Then, after that, he would show that no quantum field theory had this property. Recall that Landau had shown that quantum electrodynamics, the prototypical consistent quantum field theory, has precisely the opposite behavior. The strength of electric charges becomes larger as the scale at which you probe particles, such as electrons, gets smaller due to the cloud of virtual particles and antiparticles surrounding them. Early in 1973, Gross and his collaborator, Giorgio Parisi, had completed the first part of the proof, namely that scaling, as observed at slack, implies the strong interactions of the proton's constituents must go to zero at small distance scales if the strong nuclear force was to be described by any fundamental quantum field theory. Next, Gross attempted to show that no field theories actually had this behavior, the strength of interactions going to zero at small distance scales, which he dubbed asymptotic freedom. With help from Harvard's Sidney Coleman, who was visiting Princeton at the time, Gross was able to complete this proof for all sensible quantum field theories, except for Yang-Mills-type gauge theories. Gross now took on a new graduate student, 21-year-old Frank Wilczek, who had come to Princeton from the University of Chicago planning to study mathematics, but who switched to physics after taking Gross's graduate class in field theory. Gross was either lucky or astute, because he served as the graduate supervisor of probably the two most remarkable intellects among physicists in my generation, Wilczek and Edward Witten, who helped lead the string theory revolution in the 1980s and 1990s, and who was the only physicist to ever win the prestigious Fields Medal, the highest award given to mathematicians. Wilczek is probably one of the few true physics polymaths. Frank and I became frequent collaborators and friends in the early 1980s, and he is not only one of the most creative physicists I have ever worked with, he also has an encyclopedic knowledge of the field. He has read almost every physics text ever written, and he has assimilated the information. In the intervening years, he's made numerous fundamental contributions not only to particle physics, but to cosmology and also the physics of materials. Gross assigned Wilczek to explore with him the one remaining loophole in Gross's previous proof, determining how the strength of the interaction in Yang-Mills theories changed as one went to shorter distance scales, to prove that these theories too could not exhibit asymptotic freedom. They decided to directly and explicitly calculate the behavior of the interactions in the theories as shorter and shorter distance scales. This was a formidable task. Since that time, tools have been developed for doing the calculation as a homework problem in a graduate course. Moreover, things are always easier to calculate when you know what the answer will be, as we do now. After several hectic months with numerous false starts and numerical errors, in February of 1973, they completed their calculation and discovered, to Gross's great surprise, that in fact, Yang-Mills theories are asymptotically free. The interaction strength in these theories does approach zero as interacting particles get closer together. As Gross later put it in his Nobel address, quote, "For me, the discovery of asymptotic freedom was totally unexpected. Like an atheist who has just received a message from a burning bush, I became an immediate true believer," end quote. Sidney Coleman had assigned his own graduate student, David Politzer, to do similar calculations, and his independent result agreed with Gross and Wilczek's and was obtained at about the same time. That the results agreed gave both groups greater confidence in them. Not only can Yang-Mills theories be asymptotically free, they are the only field theories that are. This led Gross and Wilczek to suggest, in the opening of their landmark paper, that because of this uniqueness, and because asymptotic freedom seemed to be required for any theory of the strong interaction, given the 1968 slack experimental results, perhaps a Yang-Mills theory could explain the strong interaction. Which Yang-Mills theory was the right one needed to be determined, and also why the massless gauge particles that are the hallmark of Yang-Mills theories had not been seen. And, related to this, perhaps the most important long-standing question remained. Where were the quarks? But before I address these questions, you might be wondering why Yang-Mills theories have such a different behavior from their simpler cousin, quantum electrodynamics, where Landau had shown the strength of the interaction between electric charges gets larger on small distance scales. The key is somewhat subtle, and lies in the nature of the massless gauge particles in Yang-Mills theory. Unlike photons in QED, which have no electric charge, the gluons that were predicted to mediate the strong interaction possess Yang-Mills charges, and therefore gluons interact with each other. But because Yang-Mills theories are more complicated than QED, the charges on gluons are also more complicated than the simple electric charges on electrons. Each gluon not only looks like a charged particle, but also looks like a little charged magnet. If you bring a small magnet near some iron, the iron gets magnetized and you end up with a more powerful magnet. Something similar happens with Yang-Mills theories. If I have some particle with a Yang-Mills charge, say a quark, then quarks and antiquarks pop out of the vacuum around the charge and screen it, as happens in electromagnetism. But gluons can also pop out of the vacuum, and since they act like little magnets, they tend to align themselves along the direction of the field produced by the original quark. This increases the strength of the field, which in turn induces more gluons to pop out of the vacuum, which further increases the field, and so on. As a result, the deeper into the virtual gluon cloud you penetrate, i.e. the closer you get to the quark, the weaker the field will look. Ultimately, as you bring two quarks close together, the interaction will get so weak, they will begin to act as if they are not interacting at all. the characteristic of asymptotic freedom. I used gluons and quarks as labels here, but the discovery of asymptotic freedom did not point uniquely to any specific Yang-Mills theory. However, Gross and Wilczek recognized the natural candidate was the Yang-Mills theory that Greenberg and others had posited was necessary for Gell-Mann's quark hypothesis to explain the observed nature of elementary particles. In this theory, each quark contains one of three different types of charges, which are labeled, for lack of better names, by colors, say red, green, or blue. Because of this nomenclature, Gell-Mann coined a name for this Yang-Mills theory, quantum chromodynamics, QCD, the quantum theory of colored charges, in analogy to quantum electrodynamics, the quantum theory of electric charges. Gross and Wilczek posited, based on the observational arguments in favor of such a symmetry associated with quarks, that quantum chromodynamics was the correct gauge theory of the strong interaction of quarks. The remarkable idea of asymptotic freedom got an equally remarkable experimental boost within a year or so of these theoretical developments. Experiments at SLAC and at another accelerator in Brookhaven, Long Island, made the striking and unexpected discovery of a new massive elementary particle that appeared as if it might be made up of a new quark. Indeed, the so-called charm quark that had been predicted by Glashow and friends 4 years earlier. But this new discovery was peculiar, because the new particle lived far longer than one might imagine based on the measured lifetime of unstable, lighter, strongly interacting particles. As the experimentalists who discovered this new particle said, observing it was like wandering in the jungle and finding a new species of humans who lived not up to 100, but up to 10,000 years. Had the discovery been made even 5 years earlier, it would have seemed inexplicable. But in this case, fortune favored the prepared mind. Tom Applequist and David Politzer, both at Harvard at the time, quickly realized that if asymptotic freedom was indeed a property of the strong interaction, then one could show that the interactions governing more massive quarks would be less strong than the interactions governing the lighter, more familiar quarks. Interactions that are less strong would mean particles decay less quickly. What would otherwise have been a mystery was in this case a verification of the new idea of asymptotic freedom. Everything seemed to be fitting into place. Except for one pretty big thing. If the theory of quantum chromodynamics was a theory of the interaction of quarks and gluons, where were the quarks and gluons? How come none had ever been seen in an experiment? Asymptotic freedom provides a key clue. If the strength of the strong interaction gets weaker, the closer one gets to a quark, and conversely, it should get stronger and stronger the farther one is away from the quark. Imagine then what happens if I have a quark and an antiquark that are bound together by the strong interaction and I try and pull them apart. As I try to pull them apart, I need more and more energy because the strength of the attraction between them grows with distance. Eventually, so much energy becomes stored in the field surrounding the quarks that it becomes energetically favorable instead for a new quark-antiquark pair to pop out of the vacuum and then for each to become bound to one of the original particles. The process is shown schematically in the attached PDF, figure 19A. It would be like stretching a rubber band. Eventually, the band will snap into two pieces instead of stretching forever. Each piece, in this case, would then represent a new bound quark-antiquark pair. What would this mean for experiments? Well, if I accelerate a particle such as an electron and it collides with a quark inside a proton, it will kick the quark out of the proton. But as the quark begins to exit the proton, the interactions of the quark with the remaining quarks will increase, and it will eventually be energetically favored for virtual quark-antiquark pairs to pop out of the vacuum and bind to both the ejected quark and the other quarks as well. This means that one will create a shower of strongly interacting particles, such as protons or neutrons or pions or so on, moving along the direction of the original ejected quark, and similarly a shower of strongly interacting particles recoiling in the direction of motion of the original remaining quarks left over from the proton. one will never see the quarks themselves. Similarly, if a particle collides with a proton, in recoiling, sometimes the quark will emit a gluon before it binds with an antiquark popping out of the vacuum. Then, since gluons interact with each other as well as with quarks, the new gluon might emit more gluons. The gluons, in turn, will be surrounded by new quarks that pop out of the vacuum, creating new strongly interacting particles moving along the direction of each original gluon. In this case, one would expect, in some cases, to see not a single shower moving in the direction of the original quark, but several showers corresponding to each new gluon that is emitted along the way. Because quantum chromodynamics is a specific, well-defined theory, one could predict the rate at which quarks will emit gluons, and the rate at which one would see a single shower, or jet as it is called, kicked out when an electron collides with a proton or neutron, and the rate at which one would see two showers, and so on. Eventually, when accelerators became powerful enough to observe all these processes, the observed rates agreed well with the predictions of the theory. There is every reason to believe that this picture of free quarks and gluons quickly getting bound to new quarks and antiquarks so that one would never observe a free quark or gluon is valid. This is called confinement because quarks and gluons are always confined inside strongly interacting particles such as protons and neutrons and can never break free from them without getting confined in newly created strongly interacting particles. Since the actual process by which the quarks get confined occurs as the forces become stronger and stronger when the quark moves farther and farther away from its original companions, the standard calculations of quantum field theory, which are valid when the interactions are not too strong, break down. So this picture, validated by experiment, cannot be fully confirmed by tractable calculations at the moment. Will we ever derive the necessary mathematical tools to analytically demonstrate from first principles that confinement is indeed a mathematical property of quantum chromodynamics? This is the million-dollar question, literally. The Clay Mathematics Institute has announced a million-dollar prize for a rigorous mathematical proof that quantum chromodynamics does not allow free quarks or gluons to be produced. While no claimants to the prize have yet come forward, we nevertheless have strong indirect support of this idea, coming not only from experimental observations, but also from numerical simulations that closely approximate the complicated interactions in quantum chromodynamics. This is heartening, if not definitive. We still have to confirm that it is some property of the theory and not of the computer simulation. However, for physicists, if not mathematicians, this seems pretty convincing. One final bit of direct evidence that QCD is correct came from a realm where exact calculations can be done. Because quarks are not completely free at short distances, I earlier mentioned that there should be calculable corrections to exotic scaling phenomena observed in the high-energy collisions of electrons off protons and neutrons, as originally observed at SLAC. Perfect scaling would require completely non-interacting particles. The corrections that one could calculate in quantum chromodynamics would only be observable in experiments that were far more sensitive than those originally performed at SLAC. It took the development of new, higher-energy accelerators to probe them. After 30 years or so, enough evidence was in so that comparison of theoretical predictions and experiment agreed at the 1% level, and quantum chromodynamics as the theory of the strong interaction was finally verified in a precise and detailed way. Gross, Wilczek, and Politzer were finally awarded the Nobel Prize in 2004 for their discovery of asymptotic freedom. The experimentalists who had first discovered scaling at SLAC, which was the key observation that set theorists off in the right direction, were awarded the Nobel Prize much earlier in 1990. And the experimentalists who discovered the charm quark in 1974 won the Nobel Prize 2 years later in 1976. But the biggest prize of all, as Richard Feynman has said, is not the recognition